Now, today, Swanson is on his way to Selma to take part in a weekend commemoration of the anniversary. Getting back to the title of Swanson's book, everybody knows who Martin Luther King Jr. is, but Jimmie Lee Jackson, he was shot and killed by an Alabama state trooper back in 1965 as he tried to protect his mother, who had been participating in a demonstration. Jackson's death led to the Selma March, the violence, and ultimately the passage of the landmark Voting Rights Act. A black Democratic state senator says that the Department of Corrections needs to do more to reduce racial disparities in state priorities. Gilman Halstead has that story.
At a budget hearing this week, State Senator Lena Taylor told the secretary parole agents need to do a better job of helping black inmates overcome discrimination in the job market after their release from prison.
If we provide someone with programming inside, but the agents don't use that to sell them on the outside, even though we know, based on studies that have been done, that there are racial bias that exists on hiring individuals, if we're not making those connections, then we're the Department of Punishment and not the Department of Corrections.
But Secretary Wall says the $2.4 billion biennial prison budget includes $100 million in youth programming aimed specifically at helping low-income African-American juveniles stay out of the criminal justice system. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
An accident in a Lakeview Corporate Park warehouse has claimed the life of a 42-year-old man. The incident happened Tuesday morning at a company called OHL. Village police say the victim sustained a head injury and became trapped on a lift some 30 feet in the air. Life-saving efforts were performed on the scene, but the man was later pronounced dead at St. Catherine's Hospital. And the lead author of Wisconsin's controversial iron ore mining bill said he was disappointed with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for causing the mining company, Gogebic Taconite, to pull back on its proposed iron ore mine for northern Wisconsin. Rich Kramer has that story.
On Friday, GTAC announced it was closing its Hurley office, due in part to uncertainty over how the Environmental Protection Agency is dealing with an Alaskan mining project. Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany says in that case, the EPA decided to limit mining even before the company applied for a permit.
It's very clear the Environmental Protection Agency under President Obama is anti-mining. They do not want to see it happen here in the United States.
Tiffany says his iron mining bill passed last year created certainty for GTAC that they won't see at the federal level. GTAC says it still may apply for a mining permit, but can't justify the cost of keeping an office open in the state. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now 13 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check sports and weather. The NBA, the Bucks lost to Denver 106-95. The Bulls beat Washington 97-92. Tonight, the Bucks are on the road to play Golden State. The Bulls are off. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday, March 4th. Partly sunny and cold, high of 18. Tonight's low 3 below, tomorrow's high 13, Friday 30 degrees, Saturday and Sunday upper 30s. Look at this, Monday and Tuesday into the 40s. This morning, though, it's chilly. 16 degrees were seen in Kenosha, 13 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 13 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a couple of different interviews for you today. We're going to be previewing the upcoming Bix Fest, which celebrates the extraordinary artistry and legacy of Bix Beiderbecke. We'll also be hearing from the very talented creative team behind one of the most successful series of children's books in recent years, Fancy Nancy. They celebrate their 10th anniversary this year. And we're going to hear briefly from a brilliantly talented soprano who is going to be soloing with Racine Symphony in their concert that's coming up this Sunday afternoon out at UW Parkside. All of that coming up on today's morning show here on WGTD. Here is part one of today's program. I hate to intrude on that wonderful music making. That is one of the great legends of jazz, Bix Beiderbecke, and one of his best known recordings, Singing the Blues, from 1927. And this great musician is the topic of part one of today's morning show because of an event coming up which many of you probably already know something about, Bix Fest, which is a way to celebrate Bix Beiderbecke and his extraordinary legacy. And speaking of extraordinary, the extraordinary man behind Bix Fest is joining me today on this portion of the morning show, Phil Paspahala. I rattle off all these fancy classical music names, and then I'm stumbling over yours. My apologies. Paspahala, Phil Paspahala, who is... organizing yet another Bix Fest, which will occur this week and weekend, March 5th through the 8th at the Racine Marriott. And I am excited about the next few minutes to find out a little bit more about Bix Fest and especially about the great Bix Beiderbecke. Phil Paspahala, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. Maybe we could get a little capsule summary ahead of talking about this jazz legend to find out about sort of your own musical journey. Are you yourself a musician, and is that where your love of Bix began?
No, I'm actually a, and I'm proud of it, an internationally known original issue 78 RPM record collector. And I focus on the 1920s, early 30s. That's all we really care about. That's all the festival deals with. And it's a type of music which is now so old that to young people, it's become new. And I did try to play a cornet off and on for 20 years, but a combination of factors, probably lack of talent being the biggest, I put a stop to that. But I had a good time, and you figure out who and who is not a good player when you play along with the phonograph records. And you find that many musicians do this and started that way. So some connection to
it. When did your life as a collector of 78s begin? And with any particular purpose in mind, or were you just bitten by the bug to collect?
I don't know. It's with any collectible. Something strikes you and you're interested in it. I was a teenager and had a box of records, and from my aunt got them for me from a musician across the street in Wausau, Wisconsin. He was a drummer, and there were some good things in there. At the time, I knew a little bit about it because I had read a couple of books and found out all about the hot stuff from those days. And so I played them on an old phonograph. My father had a 1927 Victor Victrola portable, and that thing was heavy as sin. And I played it on that and then got myself a good a machine of the day. This would have been in the 1950s, electrical reproducing machine, and the sound was even better, and I was off and running. And you read more books, and you get more records, and then you find out others are just like you, and you can't stop.
And are we talking pretty much exclusively about records of jazz and popular music? I mean, you weren't also collecting 78s of opera legend Amelita Dallacucci. I mean,
no.
That's just not what you were into.
Exactly. It was the so-called hot stuff, the good stuff, which includes hot dance and black and white jazz of the highest order. Now, there are people who deal only in blues, and that's fine, too. They love blues from the 1920s, early 30s. But I'll tell you, blues can drone on like country music, and you fall asleep on the bar stool. I'm telling you, it's just not for me.
That's just fine. You know, as we were playing that that recording from 1927 of Bix Beiderbecke singing the blues, I remarked to you how surprised I was, pleasantly surprised, that the sound quality of that recording was as good as it was. I think most of us figure that if you're going all the way back to the 1920s, you're going to be hearing something where it sounds like they're kind of sitting under a waterfall. I mean, there'll be this roar of background noise that really obscures what you're really wanting to listen to. And, of course, that has amazing clarity. And you said something kind of interesting about how the quality of recordings advanced at some point farther than the quality of the machines that they were played back on. Just say a word about that.
Yes. The machines were probably 10 to 15 years behind. The electrical recordings made mostly at the Western Electric plant in Cicero, Illinois, changed forever the reproduction of sound. And the music industry, the phonograph industry, and the media industry at that time realized there would be a better quality of reproduction, even though the phonographs themselves were still acoustic. There were no electrical impulses in those machines. They played strictly through a reproduction. The needle hit the grooves, and it went through a horn, and depending on the size of the horn, that's the volume you got. Now, it still sounded better. It still sounded better because of that electrical recording process. Today, for example, the young musicians who have rediscovered the music most of the time play without electrical amplification. They don't need these boards with all sorts of amps and everything to jack up the sound and amplify this instrument and that. No, they play the natural reproduction, but you might have one mic like they would have had in the 20s, one microphone for performances in a hall or in a room, and that's it. And you get used to that, and it's marvelous.
And it's more real in a sense.
It is real.
Well, let's talk about specifically now jazz legend Bix Beiderbecke, who is someone you've devoted a great deal of time and energy and resources to in helping to celebrate his legacy with this event that you've created called Bix Fest. Was there a moment of dramatic epiphany where you suddenly fell in love with him, or was it kind of over the course of of months and maybe years as you listened to him that you came to really be amazed by his talent and intrigued by his story?
It happened suddenly. And I think that's with a number of icons people come to respect and enjoy. I heard his recordings, and a friend of mine, his brother was a musician, saxophone player, and he said, "Give Phil this recording. It's somebody I think he'll want to hear." And it was a reissue, but that was okay at the time, a reissue of Bix, and made around the same time as the recording you played to start the program.
Wow.
And I listened to that, and I just sat up, and I realized I was in the presence of greatness. And there was something so beautiful about it, melodically and rhythmically. And so you take off from that, and then you find out from books and other sources. And by the way, there were radio programs in those days, on FM usually, that featured good hot music, historical music. And you're off and running with it. Bix came to be the white icon of the 20s. He was a good friend of Louis Armstrong, and Louis was the African-American icon. Now, Louis lived to a decent old age and became a different character as he played the horn less and sang more. Bix was an alcoholic. In those days, there was no AA. Bix said one drink is like 200 for him. He died of Loeber pneumonia induced by alcoholic hepatitis when he was 28 years old in 1931. 28 years old in 1931. And in those days, it was not considered a sickness or an illness. And so he's in a profession where that's all musicians do is drink. So somebody was always offering him a drink, and it knocked him out. The fact that for 7 years they could get him in a recording studio and he had the power of a bear to play and get all of that out of his system onto recordings is just a miracle.
Well, and it says something about his greatness too, his brilliant talent, that even living such a short amount of time and making a relative handful of recordings compared to if he'd lived on for decades, the fact that he left such a legacy behind him, I mean, and is still so revered, says a lot about the impact that he had as a musician.
Yes, and it's not different than someone like Mozart, for example, or anybody else who died young, and regardless of the field of music. Usually your best work, it all comes to fruition when you're young and everything is grooving at the same time. When you get older and you hear musicians who've lived too long and made too many recordings, they don't they really don't sound as good as they did when they were younger. So maybe we didn't miss anything.
Interesting. Well, at any rate, there is a lot to enjoy about Bix Beiderbecke. And explain what happens at Bix Fest, the kind of celebration that this is, the sort of things that go on, and also the kind of people who come to an event like Bix Fest.
Greg, they come from 35 states, half dozen countries. In fact, a fellow who comes from Japan is bringing his new wife with him. A fellow comes from Bulgaria, come from England, from France, and of course Canada. Both coasts, well, I should say all three coasts, east, west, and south coast. And we celebrate Bix's birthday, which is March 10th. And the festival is held always on the weekend closest to his birthday. And we have the good fortune of having with us again a lovely gal, a young gal, who is Bix's great niece. She's the closest living relative to his name, Leon Bix. Bix shortened from Bismarck, family name. It was a nickname, Bix. Her name is Elizabeth Beiderbecke. And married gal, so her last name is Hart, and she runs around known as Elizabeth Beiderbecke Hart. She attends. What does that mean, that she's the great niece? Her grandfather was Bix's brother.
Okay.
Bix never married and was just too busy playing and drinking. So so she attends. And in fact, everybody's invited Thursday after our 12-hour bus tour to hell, which starts off the festival. We go to cemeteries. We go to theaters. We go to homes. We stand in front of empty lots, do all of that stuff. When we come back, we're going across the road to Pudgy's. It's a nice local bar right across from the Marriott on Highway 20, and they've said, yes, you can come in and you bring your musicians in, and we want to celebrate Liz Beiderbecke's birthday because hers is, oh, God, I should know. It's either the 7th or 8th of March.
Ah.
Very close.
So during the fest, yeah.
And so in prior years, I'd get back from the bus tour, and it was after 10 o'clock at night, and I'd hit the sack, and there would be a knock on the door, and yeah, I'd yell out from the Marriott, and there was Liz Beiderbecke on the other side. Phil, you have to come with us across the street to Pudgy's and celebrate my birthday. Oh, God, I dragged myself out there, and I'd get back at 2:30, 3 o'clock, but I was happy.
Wow.
This year, I'm planning for it.
Hmm.
So we'll start the proceeding somewhere around 8:30, 9 o'clock. I still have the bus till 10. People can go from the hotel across the highway and a couple of blocks to the west to Pudgy's. And if they want to leave by 10 o'clock, the bus will bring them back to the hotel. If they want to leave later, well, we're all on our own.
Right. Oh, that sounds like a great way to kick things off.
And we have three bands, which are the crux of the whole thing. Three orchestras. One is a Bix-type band with the current genius, young Andy Shum, who was born in Wisconsin. His parents still live in New Berlin. Hmm. And Andy plays in that band. And the other two bands are from New Orleans, all young musicians. These musicians are in their 20s and 30s, and they're going to recreate for us the new Battle of New Orleans. Andy Jackson won the first one in 1815, shook up the British after the war was technically over.
Right.
And these two New Orleans bands are going to battle for the Andy Jackson Trophy. Let's see who wins that.
So fun.
All
what
of
a great,
that.
What a great
there
idea.
Rare films. Midnight jam session, lectures on musicians of the 1920s, anything you can imagine, something for everyone, all-night record playing. Oh.
Great, and lots of things for sale, of course, including
2 days,
rare memorabilia.
Dealer tables. Right. We got a fella, a great blues collector, and he sells books, blues and jazz, and this is one of only three festivals he makes during the year because
wow.
He likes it so much.
Say a quick word about this tour that kind of kicks things off, the bus tour. So you head down to Chicago, is that?
This year, yes. Last year we went to Davenport, Iowa.
Which is where he was born.
Right. We get the bus from up the road in Franklin from the Royal Coach Company. Wonderful people. But the fella says, you know, if we had known you were going to go 200 miles, we should have charged you more. I said, well, we're going to Dubuque as well. Holy cow. Well, we figured out we couldn't make both cities. So I said, how about we cut out Dubuque? He said, okay, we'll make a deal. I won't charge you anymore. We just go to Davenport and back. That was marvelous. We barely got back in 12 hours. So.
Right. So this year, though, that tour.
It's in Chicago, yes. But it starts in Kenosha because there's one of the most historical musical buildings in America, and they're not even aware of it. I've been trying to make them aware of it and talking with the fella, Frank, who's trying to sell it for years. He's tried to sell the building. It's the old Virginian Theater on 58th Avenue near 6th Street in downtown Kenosha. It was the last public appearance of the legendary Creole jazz band featuring two jazz giants, Freddie Keppard, a great horn player before King Oliver and Louis Armstrong, and Jimmy Noon, a legendary clarinet player.
Huh.
And it closed in the 1920s as an entertainment venue. It's been everything since. We're going to go inside because the balcony is still there and so on. They turned down a record contract with Victor in 1916 because they thought somebody would steal their stuff, and they would have in those days. And so the original Dixieland Jazz Band got the first contract to record in 1917, sold a million records of their first recording, went on to let's say, promote jazz through the recording media and their performances, and the rest is world history.
Wow.
Now, but the Creole band was the first, and that became King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band because their last public performance here in Kenosha was in 1918.
Hmm.
They disbanded. Oliver took over the band. Bill Johnson, who led the Creole band, went with Oliver, and 4 years later, he brings up Louis Armstrong, and Louis goes on to become the icon of icons for the music. Even Dizzy Gillespie said, we all owe everything to Louis.
Mm.
So there you have it in a nutshell. So we think if somebody would want to buy that building, the Virginian Theater, perfect to restore as a downtown venue in Kenosha. They're looking for entertainment to revive downtown Kenosha. Perfect.
Interesting idea. So a bus tour to a lot of interesting places, and then all kinds of different events and performances and lectures and all kinds of things
on
sale.
And we go and see B. Palmer's grave on 127th and Halsted in Chicago. She was one of two people who claimed to invent the shimmy dance. Yes. The other one was Gilda Gray. And Gilda Gray came from lived in Milwaukee and invented the shimmy dance in Milwaukee. And the tavern building is still there, and we saw that one time.
Well, very good. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. So Bix Fest happens again. And how many Bix Fests have there been?
This is number 26.
Number 26. So you're on halfway to 50 of these. And if people want more information, they can go to your website, which is a lot of fun, bixfest.com.
So bixfest.com. Like the paint stripper, Bix. That's bixfest.com.
And if people also want to attend, is that where they can get information then about what this
involves?
Yes, they'll
find everything. And if all else fails or they're not computer-oriented, they can simply call me at 847-AREA. That would be Libertyville, Illinois, 847-996-0246.
Very good. Phil Paspahala, it's been great to meet you today and to learn about all the exciting things that are going to be coming up at this year's 26th annual Bix Fest. We hope a lot of people will come and enjoy all that is offered. And thanks for joining us today on The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be hearing the creative team behind the highly successful Fancy Nancy children's book series, which celebrates its 10th anniversary this year. Tomorrow on the Morning Show, one of our interviews will be with Pascal Lorino, who is the music director of the Racine Symphony Orchestra. And they have an exciting concert coming up on March 8th, and we'll be talking about it on tomorrow's Morning Show. The concert is going to be in beautiful Francis Bedford Hall, in the RITA, the RITA Talent Pickens Center for Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. It will be a concert that will feature not only the presence of the Choral Arts Society, but a couple of very, very talented vocal soloists, including soprano Alicia Bernecki. She is going to be featured in a masterpiece by American composer Samuel Barber called Knoxville, Summer of 1915. Here is a sampling of her singing in a recording made with the Minnesota Orchestra. This is an excerpt from Carl Orff's 20th century masterwork, Carmina Burana. Again, this is soprano Alicia Bernecki, who will be appearing with the Racine Symphony Orchestra on their next concert. Gorgeous music from Carl Orff's Carmina Burana, and that singing by soprano Alicia Bernecki, one of two soloists to be featured on the concert of the Racine Symphony this Sunday afternoon, March 8th, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, in beautiful Francis Bedford Hall in the RITA Talent Pickens Center for Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. We will have an interview with conductor Pascal Lorino, music director of the symphony, during tomorrow's morning show. In the meantime, if you'd like more information, you're invited to go to the symphony's website, racinesymphony.org, or you can call 636-9285. Well, on the bookshelves of my niece, Lorelei, who is a voracious reader of all kinds of things, there are a number of books that she especially prizes in the series called Fancy Nancy. And Fancy Nancy is 10 years old, and a beautiful book has been released to celebrate that milestone. Plus a book that's in a little bit different format, but the very same character called Nancy Clancy, star of stage and screen. And we're going to be talking about both of these books and about the whole Fancy Nancy phenomenon with the two women responsible, Jane O'Connor, who writes these books, and Robin Price Glasser, who is responsible for the illustrations that really bring the words to life. We welcome both of you to the morning show, and happy anniversary to you.
Oh, thank you, Greg. We appreciate it.
So tell us, first of all, how the two of you met and how this partnership began.
Well, I wrote the first Fancy Nancy story about 12 or 13 years ago and sent it to an editor, Margaret Anastas at HarperCollins. And it was Margaret who made the marriage between Robin and me. Margaret thought the minute she read the story that Robin was the perfect person to illustrate the book.
And did she give any reason why?
Actually, she did. She said to me that what she loved about Robin's art was that it was a combination of being both really pretty and really funny, and that it would appeal to the kind of little girls you see in Target who, you know, their moms are in jeans and T-shirts, and they're following in their ball gowns. And Margaret was just right on the money.
And it's been a beautiful partnership ever since.
Absolutely.
Robin Price Glaser, one of the interesting things about your career is that you are both this wonderful illustrator, and you've been a ballet dancer as well. Tell us how those two pursuits have been part of each other. Have they been very separate tracks in your life, very separate experiences in two very discrete arenas?
Somebody said to my father many years ago, I'll never forget, you must be so proud of your daughter. First she was a professional ballet dancer, and now she's a successful illustrator. And he said, well, you know, if she'd been a ballet dancer and then became a rocket scientist or something, that would be something. But basically, she, as a little girl, she used to jump around and dance all over the place. Now she's just drawing other little people jumping up and dancing all over the place on the page. So it's sort of the same thing. It's really the same part of my brain. And I also find that because I looked at bodies in motion for the first 30 years of my life, I really know how body parts move. And I think that it has made my characters come to life. I always draw my characters mid-flight, in the middle, going from point A to point B. They're never just standing there. They're usually in the middle of the motion.
You know, I
that comes from dance.
South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
That are, or pictures, I should say, that are relatively static of Nancy's dad relaxing his recliner, we still feel like that is a snapshot of him in motion, that he has just turned to look at Nancy, and it feels alive. And and the hands of another illustrator, that would feel like an entirely static, lifeless sort of pose.
I think also what Robin does so amazingly well is you can tell exactly what Nancy's feeling just by looking at the way her body is.
The body language.
Yes. You wouldn't even have to see her facial expression. You can just tell. She registers every emotion through her body.
And that came from my dance career.
Huh.
So I said it's just an extension of, I can't move anymore, I'm too old, but I'm making my character move for me.
Jane O'Connor, I want you to talk about crafting this character of Fancy Nancy. You've already described a little bit about what we're talking about. I mean, a little girl who comes from a, a relatively plain, straightforward family, but who wants to be fancy and loves adorning herself with the fanciest things she can find. One of the things that intrigues me the most is that you take this character and you make her so lovable and so adorable, but it feels like it would be very easy to paint this character in a different way and for her to come off kind of obnoxious or pretentious, yeah, or all kinds of other things that would not, yeah, be nearly so likable. Talk about how you have crafted this character so she is none of those things I just said and instead is so endearing.
She does go right up to that line, though.
Yeah, but I really am very mindful of not crossing it. She gets herself in trouble from being overly exuberant rather than being obnoxious and I can do anything. In the new chapter book, she, for the very first time, Nancy is in a school play where she's not the chorus. She's not one of the villagers in the Pied Piper of Hamelin. She's not dwarf number 7 in Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. She's got a little moment under the spotlight, and she's thrilled, and of course it goes awry. So it's very much what a typical child who isn't. I just finished writing, and it was really fun, a book about soccer, where she's on a soccer team. And in the first line in the book, she tells her best friend, Bree, all she wants is to be mediocre. She doesn't want to be the worst. She knows she'll never be the best. So she has realistic expectations for herself and yet is exuberant and gets fully caught up in anything and often gets a little too caught up. But I know exactly what you're saying, and I don't want her to be, like, in-your-face obnoxious and too diva-like. She feels everything deeply, but her family also is the reins. Mm-hmm. They pull her in when she starts going too far.
Right. I guess
there's a whole lot of heart in these books, and that helps. That always tempers anything that could be obnoxious. When there's this love and this coming from the heart rather than from the brain.
Right.
That's from the brain.
I think the other thing that I'm glad you avoid is that this also doesn't feel like she's in a sense a shallow little girl or a materialistic little girl,
no,
because we sometimes, no, of course, see that too. And she's not that. But I'm amazed at how you've managed to sort of skirt that, because I think someone else writing this very same story, trying to create a similar character, it just seems like that would be a pitfall very easily fallen into. And you don't. I mean, I love the way she's been created.
She is a very much create it yourself girl. When I wrote the first story, Nancy transforms her room from a very plain white all IKEA furniture room into this extravaganza of fanciness. But she's done it all herself. I wanted, and in my notes to the illustrator, who I didn't even know then would be Robin, I said I want her to make a canopy bed out of an old sheet and a mop and a broom. So she's not entitled. She has to create whatever glamour she wants by her own means. And it's, I think, more fun to do it that way, too.
And it's funny, too. I mean, to see what she's created with a plunger and a feather duster, you know. it's much funnier than buying something extravagant.
Right, and of course that's the thing too. Nancy is not going to the store to become fancy with all kinds of expensive things. She's creating fancy out of her own imagination, which is
Yes, and she is a very imaginative kid.
Right.
And the big words are a big part of it, the fancy words.
Oh, yes.
You know, she speaks with big words. The teachers and the parents really love the vocabulary.
Right. As in
that, I saw it as part of her character, that throwing out $5 words was also very fancy.
Sure. As when she says, "My favorite color is fuchsia." That's a fancy way of saying purple.
Purple, right.
More ordinary people just say purple. She says fuchsia.
Yes.
Well, and for instance, in this 10th anniversary book, where she and her family, all dressed in fancy doodads, go out for a fancy parfaits, as she goes up to the counter to bring these back, we see that the fancy leggings she's wearing, one on one leg, they've come undone, and so she has all this material straggling behind her and doesn't even realize it, but it doesn't even matter, and it's just part of what makes her more endearing.
She's wearing a ballet slipper, a pointe shoe with the laces that have come undone, and then she trips over her own fanciness, and that's sort of part of the horror of it. You see young kids, when we read that story, they put their hands over their face like, oh, no, this is the worst thing in the world. It's so big for them.
Right, because, I mean, I remember as a child just embarrassing myself was the worst thing that could possibly happen. And, I mean, actually, I feel that way now as well. Yes. My whole motto in life is avoid humiliation. And Nancy often can't avoid humiliation. And some of that comes into play in Nancy Clancy's Starved Stage and Scream.
And a real quick question about that. That's a little longer book. It's not so much a picture book, although there are lovely illustrations, but that's more of
a
book for
us.
Yeah, chapter book for slightly older readers. Has that been a challenge to kind of move into this different area with the same character?
Actually not, because when I started writing children's books, my very first book was about a 9-year-old girl, and I feel comfortable writing longer. It's harder for me to write a picture book, and I was getting letters from girls saying, I'm in third grade now, and I read chapter books, and I've loved the Fancy Nancy picture books, but do you ever think about making her older? And it was like, boing! why not do that? And it's been really fun. And I have things in the books that are from my own experiences. When I was in third grade, I was obsessed with Nancy Drew. And so Nancy Clancy and her best friend Bree, they want to be sleuths and are reading all these Nancy Drew books. So everything comes into play.
Well, congratulations to both of you, Jane O'Connor, Robin Price Glasser, for all that you've created with Fancy Nancy and the new Nancy Clancy chapter books. And may you go on for many years to keep creating wonderful books.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be hearing from Pasquale Laurino, the music director of the Racine Symphony, talking about a couple of very exciting concerts coming up with the Racine Symphony, including one this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock in the beautiful Francis Bedford Hall of the Rita Pickin Talent Pickin Center for Arts and Humanities on the campus of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Also tomorrow, we will preview Carthage College's Fine Arts Weekend, which is coming up this weekend with a whole host of exciting events. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Today is going to be a partly sunny, cold day with a high of 18 degrees, overnight low of 3 below. Tomorrow, Thursday, sunny and a high of just 13. But on Friday, we warm to 30s and the upper 30s by Saturday and Sunday, low 40s.